impulse to go unrecognized.
Again, good morning, and this is Omar Shabazz sitting in for Cameron Andrews on your program, An Islamic Point of View. We have been listening to Imam Fahim Shoaib of Oakland, California, and it was on his lecture was on essential principles for self-evolution and self-development. And this particular subject was on hidden faults in human development. We invite you now to stay tuned for Pathways.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Divination Foundation, offering the enlightened decision-making system to help people and organizations make the right moves at the right time. More information at www.divination.com. That's divination.com.
Good morning and welcome to Pathways. This and today, once again, it's my pleasure to welcome a traveling author to Pathways. And I have with me this morning Curtis White, and his book is The Middle Mind, Why Americans Don't Think for Themselves. So folks, this is going to be delicious for me. I hope you enjoy it too. I really want to hear from Curtis White about what brought on this project. Good morning, Kurt.
Good morning.
First, would you please tell us who you are and what you're up to these days?
Well, I grew up in the East Bay from San Francisco in what was called a vet village, San Lorenzo. It was created on sort of the Levittown model right after World War II.
Morning show. Good morning and welcome to Pathways. This is Tom Park, your host today. And today, once again, it's my pleasure to welcome a traveling author to Pathways. And I have with me this morning Curtis White, and his book is The Middle Mind, Why Americans Don't Think for Themselves. So folks, this is going to be delicious for me. I hope you enjoy it too. I really want to hear from Curtis White about what brought on this project. Good morning, Kurt.
Good morning.
First, would you please tell us who you are and what you're up to these days?
Well, I grew up in the East Bay from San Francisco in what was called a vet village, San Lorenzo. It was created on sort of the Levittown model right after World War II. And I grew up there in the 50s and 60s. And then fortunately for me, I was around during the boom of the counterculture. And for me, a lot of the things that I thought my world had planned for me were fortunately disrupted by the 60s and the counterculture, as I was giving a reading at Cody's the other day and was sort of thanking the people of Berkeley for saving me in certain ways, because we would come down when we were in high school and drop into Berkeley. And one of the things that I think we experienced there was, of course, the fact that the world can be other than it was back in our little suburban home of stucco houses. And subsequent to that, I went to the University of San Francisco from 1969 to 73, where I was an English major and a draft counselor and someone learning how to refuse the imperatives of the dominant culture. Then I went to graduate school and got a PhD at the University of Iowa. I didn't know when I moved back to the Middle West that I would end up staying there for the rest of my life, but to this point that's been the case. I've been in Normal, Illinois for the last 24 years, teaching at Illinois State University.
Very cool. What brought about this focus you're on now, the Middle Mind?
Well, my career has been basically the career of a novelist, and I've written six books of fiction in the last 15 years or so. And I started doing essays about 3 years ago that were focused on culture. And so I was always looking at the culture, you know, keeping my eyes open, looking for things. And about three summers ago, I became increasingly irritated. I think part of the problem was that I found myself in the car while Terry Gross's Fresh Air was on one too many times. And I also saw the movie Saving Private Ryan by Steven Spielberg.
Yes.
And a couple of other things that I was reading at the time that were pretending to be kind of serious works of sociology or theology, and at the same time seeming to me to be not that at all. So I had to ask myself the question whether these things were all just sort of hopelessly individually mediocre, or if they might be said to represent some kind of American mind. And being a fiction writer, I decided that it would be interesting, whether they were an American mind or not, to pretend that they were and see where that led me. So I wrote an essay called The Middle Mind and published it first in Context magazine. And that was picked up by Harper's magazine as one of its readings. Following that, there was a tremendous brouhaha nationally that I could never have predicted, because apparently I had attacked one of our sacred cows in the person of Terry Gross. And I think Harper's set some sort of record for, or I set a record for Harper's for hate mail. I was the Fresh Air fans responded in masses to what I had done in that essay. Following that,
this inspired you to write a book.
Yeah, I sort of. It inspired somebody to ask me to write a book. One of the editors at Harper San Francisco, Gideon Weil, contacted me and suggested that there was a book idea in this somewhere. And although I resisted the idea at first, we eventually arrived at a notion of a kind of book that could be written that we would both be happy with. It didn't end up being a book entirely about the so-called middle mind. It ended up being a much larger book about the relationship between art and culture, art and politics, or the way I ended up putting it was the social imagination. It's a book about the social imagination.
Very cool. That really captured me to hear you capsulize this as social imagination. What do you mean by that?
The social imagination for me has two parts. The first part is a capacity for critiquing what exists, and the second part is an ability to project something other than what exists propositionally into the future. In other words, the imagination for me is one part critique and one part proposition. So those are the two inescapable functions of that. What's critical in the present time, and what's dysfunctional about the social imagination, or what's impoverished about the social imagination in the present, is that we have no capacity for creating distance, a distance between ourselves and sort of dominant realities, in this case, dominant corporate realities.
Is this just our culture, or you think as human beings, you mean?
I think, well, no, it's not certainly as human beings. I think it is our culture, and maybe it's also the culture in the West in generally, but it certainly is true of American culture. And the metaphor that I've been using to describe this situation actually comes from the philosopher Wittgenstein, And he asks us to imagine a fly in a bottle that wants to know what the bottle looks like. Now, the only way for a fly in a bottle to know what a bottle looks like is to imagine a space outside of the bottle from which it can look at the bottle. It's a purely imaginary space. But the important thing there is the sense of distance that is achieved by imagining this space outside of the bottle. So that bottle for us is obviously a metaphor for culture. And in our case, I think the problem isn't so much that we're in a bottle and we don't want to know what it looks like. I think we don't know we're in a bottle. And
fabulous. Fabulous.
And so that presents all kinds of social, political, and I think also spiritual problems for us.
See, this show, Pathways, is about being aware. So this is exactly the occasion of you being here today, Kurt.
Mm-hmm.
We very likely don't even know we're contained.
Right.
In a culture, in a bottle.
Well, that's sort of what the culture means to do. You said that you were attracted to the implied question on the cover of the book, why don't Americans think for themselves? And I'm frequently interviewed and asked the question, well, you know, why don't they? And usually the interviewer is very happy and eager to suggest, it's because we're stupid, isn't it? Or we're lazy, or we're something else. And my response is always, you know, I don't believe in projecting individual failings upon the body politic, on the public. You know, that's a silly thing to try to do. Americans as such are no stupider than any other people you could name. But I think the answer to the question is that we're very well managed.
Really?
Which leads to the next point, which is, you know, how is it that the social imagination is as impoverished as it is in the moment? Why is it that we don't know we're in a bottle? Why is it that we can't create this sort of imaginative distance between a critical point of view and the culture that we reside in?
Especially since we consider ourselves to be free people.
Right.
We consider ourselves to really be creating our own path that we're walking here, theoretically.
Yeah, right. And one of the questions I think my book asks most powerfully, implicitly, is who owns the future? And, you know, one of the things I always point back to is the fact that when I was growing up in the 60s in the Bay Area, the most powerful fiction I thought I was operating under was the idea that the future was open to my participation. It was open to possibility, that the future could be different than the present. And my sense is that nobody would believe that now. That my sense is that if you ask somebody who owns the future now, assuming that question made any sense to them at all, they would probably say, well, Walmart does, or corporations do. But, you know, the idea that we have a role in the shaping of the future seems very distant to us. You know, well, we'll wait and hear what Wall Street's doing, and that's how we'll tell where the future is going to be, you know. But to get back to the point about managing the imagination, I think in many ways that this is still a part of the old stories, a story of reacting against the 60s, you know, that we've been with since the big chill, you know, in the late 70s. And I think that the powers that be, you know, the ruling order, the power elite, whatever you want to call it, realized about the 60s was that when the imagination is at large, and that's the way I put it in the book, when the imagination is at large, like a madman or a criminal, it can be very powerful. It can be very destabilizing, and it is certainly inefficient. You know, it's not easy to get it to do any one thing, especially if your motive is a sort of a bottom line logic. The imagination, when it's at large in the social, is not necessarily an efficient thing. So in this culture, you can't simply deny the imagination, but you can limit and manage it. And that's where I talk about what are the three great institutional enemies of the imagination.
But you went too quickly for me there. You can't. You say that again, you can't deny it, but you can what?
Manage it.
You can manage it.
You can't, you know, the powers of the imagination can't be entirely denied. You can't tell the culture that they can't invent anymore, but you can limit the degree to which they can, and you can limit the effect of it.
Who's you in this case?
Who's they, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's why I said, you know, whether you're talking about the ruling order or the power elite, the status quo, whatever. Yeah, I mean, it's a very difficult thing to say because it isn't a particular person. And in a certain sense, it's the, you know, political institutions that I then give more detail to that are doing the work. It's almost autonomous at this point. You know, you don't need anybody to be giving directions. The system itself seems to function almost autonomously to limit the imagination.
It's just so overwhelmingly, it seems complex and just gargantuan. It's, mm-hmm. it's like there's a momentum, isn't it?
Well, I try to limit its the chaos or the confusion caused by these things. So I look at three, what I call the antagonists of the imagination.
Thank you.
It's a kind of a dramatic way of putting it.
Very good.
Maybe even soap opera-ish way of putting it. But I talk about one is the middle mind itself, and that is properly speaking, the area of the media and entertainment. The second is academic orthodoxy, and so I have a chapter upon how the academic institutions have been functioning in relationship to the social imagination. And then the final one is political ideology, and there are a lot on the technological imagination. And those three things, for me, institutionally function to manage the power of the social imagination, manage and limit it. One quick example would be the extent to which the arts. Now, when I talk about the arts, that the imagination and the arts are not the same thing. Arts are part of the social imagination. But for me, the social imagination is any part of the culture that touches upon the creation of the human world. So that can include the technological imagination. It can certainly include the way we think about science, it's politics, it's everything within the culture. But arts are still a very primary and powerful part of that imagination. Now, if you look back to the 60s, the arts were much more public than they are now. They were much more in the public. Andre Kudrescu likes to talk about getting on a bus in the middle to late 60s and always seeing three or four people carrying a book of poetry or reading the poetry on the bus in San Francisco at that time. You know, they would have Gregory Corso or Lawrence Ferlinghetti or Gary Snyder or whoever, you know.
I used to carry a book of poetry in the 60s, and I was in New Hampshire.
Yeah, right. You know. Well, I mean, I'm just telling you where he was at the time. And he said, where are those people now? What happened to them? You know, and there was certainly a sense in which literature, theater, music, poetry, the visual arts through pop art. I mean, even Andy Warhol was sort of in the community. You could go down to the factory in the East Village and, you know, it was just much more present in everybody's lives. And now the arts have retreated since then in the course of the last 30 years into what the art critic Dave Hickey calls therapeutic institutions. Institutions that claim to be working on our interests, that want our sort of cultural health, but really function in a certain way to deaden the arts and the imagination. So poets now are read by other poets.
Okay, is there a malicious streak to this, or is it just the way that the momentum carries on? There's not actually
that's not a diagnosis that's possible, I think, to make finally, you know, to find sort of culpability or responsibility for these things. And I'm not even sure how important it is.
All right.
But, you know, all we really need to say is that that these forces of management are out there and they have these kinds of consequences. But in any way you look at it, if the arts are all wrapped up in museums and academic institutions or in philanthropic groups or in art councils or whatever, they have been removed from the public and they have lost their power to have a role with the public in a way that I think has real consequences for the capacity of a broadly based social imagination to function.
How completely do you think that's taken place?
It's taken place enough that it has really defanged, if you will, or defused
wow.
what was, in the 60s at least, something that was very powerful.
You very know, vital.
I don't mean to glorify or be nostalgic about the 60s. I just talk about that period because it was the last time we saw the imagination at large.
Wow.
And what I advocate is, you know, is simply people thinking about ways of returning to that process where the imagination was, that we could claim the imagination, that we weren't waiting for people in the management and advertising department, that your friendly local international corporation to sort of imagine the future for you. You know, well, what's the next big thing? Well, we'll have to wait till we get the next issue of Rolling Stone to find out where, you know, the corporations will announce the future to us. That's a kind of police state when you get right down to it.
Wow.
And I was saying, I was having this conversation with the audience in Berkeley the other night, and the talk moved around to Walmart. And I said, I really don't care what we call the police state. You can call it Sam's Club if you want. The proof is of the pudding is in the eating. You know, if it functions like a police state, then it's a police state.
Wow. So is this a fairly gloomy time that we're going through? Is it a bit gloomy to you?
If you're not a little gloomy about the state of the world at present, I don't think you're paying any attention at all.
Fascinating.
But this is not necessarily an old story. I think there was more resistance and more hope, more refusal of that gloom, in the '60s when the imagination was at large. But it doesn't mean that it's dead and gone. The epigraph to Theodore Adorno's Minima Moralia is, life does not live. And the thing that I'm encouraging people to do, when they say, well, what are we supposed to do about this? You give us this gloomy description of the death of the imagination, and what are we supposed to do about it? And they say, well, live. If life under corporate capitalism is not living, then find a way of living. I mean, what other more direct way is there to refuse that order? And I can't tell people how to do more than that. I sort of found my own way. But what I also say is that people who are really alive have a kind of aura about them. And I've known many people who are really alive, and they're still here among us, and they've always attracted me, and they've attracted me to their projects. You get involved in their projects, and that's how the socializing process begins to happen.
Right.
The counterculture was in many ways a kind of an example of individuals who refused to be dead in their lives, who lived powerfully and attracted others.
Very good.
Then that whole process began to grow alchemically. Sometimes it grew in ways that we weren't too happy about. But
can you see any instances today in current culture where do you have any examples of that still happening anyway?
Yeah, sure. I think that, for example, the interplay between popular music groups like Radiohead and the anti-globalization movement or the environmental movement. I mean, Radiohead's got a very interesting artistic approach to the problem of technical rationality. We live in a technically rationalized world. And Radiohead has a very interesting way of engaging that world through its art. Now, the way in which it motivates and empowers and encourages people who are working in the anti-globalization movement is, to me, very striking and very hopeful. So there's at least that.
Okay, cool. Nothing on the scale of world-known characters, that type of thing. You don't see anything of that magnitude that brings you hope?
You mean like,
because Radiohead's not quite totally mainstream. It's not a household word.
No, and you wouldn't want it to be mainstream. What you want is dissonance, and Radiohead is modestly dissonant. I mean, Radiohead is also taken up by EMI Capital, but it's very aware of its place in that corporate mainstream culture. I mean, it's being used for profit, just as I'm being used for profit. This is a profitable book, fortunately, I guess, because I might get a chance to write another someday.
Right.
But at the same time, it's a book I hope that is causing a certain amount of dissonance within the culture.
Very good. So let's talk about the spiritual overlay.
Uh-huh.
And I was fascinated by some of your comments before we started tape about that. Social problems are spiritual problems?
To me, there's very little difference between what I talk about as the social imagination and spiritual life. And I think part of the problem, one of the bottles that we're in this culture that we don't seem to know how to look at or get a perspective on, get any distance from, is the idea that the spirit is somehow a transcendental thing. It's outside of this world. And if we want to be in touch with the spirit, we have to get a medium, like that guy on TV, I forget his name, that will put us into contact with our
Edwards or John Prague, one of them.
Yeah, somebody, who's passed away in our family, and he knows exactly what they're thinking and they're sending messages. To me, I won't pass any judgment on it, whether it's true or false, but insofar as it says that that's the only spiritual possibility, I think it's a very dangerous thing to be said. My own thinking goes back to, and I'd like to think of my work as a kind of return to the German philosopher Hegel, who, for all of his abstruseness and difficulty, he said something very simple as well. And I mean, the title of his book was The Phenomenology of Spirit, which means that you experience spirit all the time. Every time you walk out the door or every time you encounter your door, you're experiencing spirit. Because for Hegel, spirit was literally what you think and how you act what you think in the world. So if our world has a grotesque imbalance between military spending and educational spending, that's a commentary not just on a social political reality, but on a spiritual reality. And it doesn't say anything very pleasant about our spiritual reality. If our society is too much a kind of prison, especially for black males, then that says something about the spiritual content, not just the social justice content of our culture. And I think if we approached questions of spirit as a much more ordinary thing, a matter of ethical community, as Hegel put it, I think that we would have both more imagination and a healthier culture.
It could be that we could approach spirit both as what you're saying and as a transcendent.
I don't deny that.
It doesn't need to be one of the other.
Right. But the what I want to deconstruct, if you will, is the radical opposition between the secular and the sacred.
Very nice.
For me, the secular, that is to say, the world that we walk in, and this and the sacred are both part of a religious viewpoint.
Sounds very healthy to me. Indeed. So we have about 3 or 4 minutes left.
Sure.
I want to give you a chance. Is there some hope? Can you bring us or a call to action?
Well, I wouldn't have written the book if I didn't feel hopeful, and I think the process of writing the book was a certain kind of call, you know.
Do people first need to comprehend how they're in the bottle? Is that prerequisite that they have to kind of grok that before there's any real opportunity to move to the next step?
I think so. You know, I don't. It seems to me, you know, we can't simply go into a sort of a frenzy of a fantasy of creativity without sort of without some sort of understanding of the context within which we're doing that. I think that any kind of sort of activity of the imagination needs to be mindful of its purposes. You know, I'm hopeful because I know I'm not dead. I'm not dead yet, you know. And I'd like to think that I'm a kind of provocation to corporate cultural realities. You know, as if you know, when you stand up and you make something, and it's clear that that something is not entirely in line with dominant realities, that's always a kind of resistance. Now, the real problem for us, because I don't think there's necessarily a shortage of people who do that, and I don't think there's a shortage of people who feel that way and act that way. What there is the real problem is with what I call social penetration.
Wow.
What we have to do is figure out a way to get this life of the imagination, socialize it, and achieve social penetration. That's why the managing institutional forces that I look at are so critical. And that's the things we really have to defeat. In other words, we have to defeat the media. We have to defeat the academy as a place where the arts are removed from the public.
Is defeat the best word? Is that the word to use here?
I don't know. That's a good question. That's a fair question. And I'm not sure it's the right or best word. Because I'm not really sure how this confrontation will take place. But I do know, you know, it's no secret to anybody that the Clear Channel Corporation owns most of the airspace in this country now. And that sort of limiting reality is a problem. And we have to find a way of whatever the word you think is more appropriate, defeat it, challenge it, supplant it, do an end run on it. You know, I don't really care what it is that we do to it as long as we stop letting it live our lives for us.
Okay, I'm going to invite you to come back in about 30 seconds after I announce the contact info for you.
Okay.
And just give us a final thought.
All right.
So I'll give you a little warning. Folks, here's the way to have contact with Curtis White. Number one, there's the website for his book. It's called, of course, www.themiddlemind.com. Just like it sounds, themiddlemind.com. I think the best way, if you really want to be in touch with Kurt, is... CK White at ilstu.edu. I'll spell it again, folks. It's actually ckwhite at illinoisstateuniversity.edu. But it is ckwhite at ilstu.edu. And that is actually Kurt's email. He's generous enough to share that with us, so there's a way, folks, for you to communicate with Kurt beyond the show. Kurt, we have about, oh gosh, we got a minute or so. Just give me a parting thought to inspire.
Well, I'll tell my parting thought is I'm going to tell you what I was trying to accomplish in this book, and in some ways it seems to me to be a decent formula for anybody trying to stay alive in this culture and socialize their most provocative and positive impulses. And I was trying to do three things. I was trying to make something beautiful. I wanted this book to be beautiful in the way that my novels are beautiful, I hope. And I wanted to misbehave. That is to say, I wanted to talk about things I'm not supposed to talk about. And I think that the book has an abundance of things that I'm not supposed to talk about because I'm not expert in them. So in that way, it's a gesture against the culture of expertise.
Very good.
And the third thing that I wanted to do was I wanted to win. That is to say, I wanted to be persuasive. And so that seems to me, in some ways, if someone wants to sort of create a model for activity, to make something beautiful, to misbehave, and to win is a good way of going about it.
Very nice. Very nice. Folks, so it's been my pleasure today to welcome Curtis White. The book is The Middle Mind, subtitle Why Americans Don't Think for Themselves. Kurt, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure.
We'll be back next Sunday morning, folks. Thanks for joining us on Pathways.
We want to thank you for tuning in this morning to Pathways with Tom Park. And he's had a wonderful subject this morning. And we want to advise you, as we advise ourselves, pay attention to these types of messages because they are good for our understanding. Now we invite you to stay tuned for the Islamic Hour with Lucia.